Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of hepatobiliary cancers with Dr. Katie Kelly from the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of California, San Francisco. This is the second webinar. The first one we did a few weeks ago with Dr. Abu Alfa. It'll be interesting to contrast his views with Dr. Kelly. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We know a lot of people end up listening to these webinars. And if you're into audio programs, check out our podcast series, Oncology Today, including a recent program on biliary tract cancers with Dr. Valle. Next Monday and Tuesday, we're going to try a little experiment. We're actually going to host a world premiere of two enduring programs that we're about to publish. The first on Monday with Drs. Bradley and Spiegel, looking at the management of lung cancer with locally advanced disease that's not surgically resectable. Of course, Dr. Spiegel did the classic Pacific study. We'll talk about that. And then on Tuesday, we have Dr. Modi, who did the plenary presentation at ASCO on TDXD and HER2-low breast cancer. That's a really exciting presentation and discussion. And then on Wednesday, we'll continue our Meet the Professor series in ovarian cancer with Professor Letterman. And on Saturday, I'm actually heading out to Las Vegas to the Bellagio. We're doing a day-long meeting. It's going to start at 9 in the morning, but actually 12 Eastern time. We have some great faculty who all be appearing virtually with the American Oncology Network, who will be there with me live. We'll start out actually at 12 o'clock noon on Eastern time with breast cancer with Drs. Burstein and O'Shaughnessy, and we'll just follow it up with other modules on main topics with a great faculty. So come on out on Saturday, a week from Saturday. Then on Thursday, August 11th, Dr. Sands will be talking about small cell cancer and Meet the Professor series. Dr. Strickler on the 17th to continue our upper GI series. But today we're here to talk about hepatobiliary cancers and actually some pretty recent developments that we want to query Dr. Kelly about. But for now, we're going to also present a bunch of cases from docs in practice who are going to be presenting cases both of hepatic HCC as well as biliary tract cancers. But Katie, I just want to start out with a couple of papers that you wrote and some data that was just presented at the ESMO GI meeting. First, this paper, I wasn't even aware of this, quote, journal that does the review articles coming out of Nature, but you were part of this. It was like amazing paper, 28-page, everything you ever want to hear about HCC, phenomenal graphics. Anything you want to say about the paper just to kind of let people know about it? There's so much in there, Katie. I guess this is the new textbook of HCC. Any comments about sort of putting it together and anything in there that you may want to comment on?
Oh, thank you. No, I was honored to be invited to be part of this by Joseph Yove, who led the effort. Nature Review Disease Primers really provide a cross stages, cross molecular profiling, cross discipline approach to tumor types. And as you can see from the author list, HCC is highly multidisciplinary with hepatology, medical oncology, interventional radiology, surgeons, molecular medicine folks all represented in the authorship. I guess I've been using this paper to cite epidemiology updates because it really does delve into why we're seeing more cases of HCC, more deaths from HCC, particularly in the Western world due to NAFLD. So our epi colleagues have gone into that with this paper. And then it also is, I think, a handy review of the sea change in systemic therapy that we've seen over the past 5 years, in that this really delves into the data underlying the new tyrosine kinase inhibitors and the immunotherapy that we're starting to use in the clinic.
Yeah, so it's July, I guess, time for the new fellows are just on board. So I guess if you're a new fellow, you want to hear about HCC, you've got a couple of days to read through this paper. I recommend it. Just one other thing that goes is discussed in the paper, not by you, but one of the other authors, Katie, is the issue of screening. And I hear stories from docs about, seeing patients with cirrhosis with cytopenias, get consulted for that. And then, them saying, hey, are you screening this patient for HCC? Anything you want to say about that strategy and whether, think moving forward, there's going to be any yield in terms of earlier diagnosis and better long-term outcome?
Well, I think it is important to remember that anyone with more advanced stages of fibrosis, or Frank's cirrhosis, whatever the cause, whether it's NAFLD or hepatitis virus or alcohol, should be screened. And our hepatology as well as oncology guidelines, including NCCN, recommend this. So at least twice annually with either ultrasound or CT or MRI and AFP periodically at those same intervals. And then for patients with higher risk features such as hepatitis B, and even at a younger age, even without Frank cirrhosis, may warrant screening depending on their demographics.
So here's another great paper that you did, another review article looking at kind of the biology of HCC. And then, of course, this paper you did in the New England Journal with Tim Gretton, which was really a commentary on a paper from Nature looking at NASH and the issue of immunotherapy. I've been asking people for a long time now, you know, is there any difference in how people respond to therapy with HCC based on the etiology? You know, and head and neck cancer, I've been asking the same thing. You have the same issue, viral, non-viral, and looks like immunotherapy works pretty similarly. But this really gets into another thought that really maybe NASH-related HCC is biologically very different. And the question of whether it's going to respond as well to immunotherapy. Can you kind of, you know, there's a lot of details and great diagrams. Maybe you can use this one to really kind of talk through it. But can you kind of review this, the thinking now that maybe there is going to be, and maybe we're moving towards different subsets based on
definitely
etiology?
The Pfister Nature paper, of which this diagram is a recapitulation of the data, right, the bottom panel there from Pfister et al., really pointed out that the immune microenvironment in NASH itself, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is different than in viral hepatitis, in particular with different profiles of T cells, and some which have sort of both of an exhausted and an activated phenotype. That in animal models seems to have a poorer response or lack of response to immune checkpoint inhibition by comparison to non-NAFLD contexts. And they followed this paper up with a meta-analysis of several of the contemporary phase 3 immunotherapy trials that we've had in HCC. And they looked at overall survival as an endpoint by non-viral compared to viral etiologies, and they showed significant benefit for viral, but really no significant difference compared to the control arm for the non-viral. And so they posited that the immune microenvironment in the NAFLD setting may be different and interfering with response. And so incredibly interesting hypothesis. I think that the HCC is so complicated, though, that when one really delves into the details, it's probably more than just the immune microenvironment. It is certainly possible that the viral, and likely that the immune microenvironment of virus associated HCC is different. However, if we look at objective response rates and even PFSs of immune checkpoint inhibitors for viral versus non-viral, they're not that different. Non-viral and NASH patients still can have good responses, and the objective response rates aren't that different. Where we see the difference is in the overall survival, and that actually ties in a lot of confounding variables like comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension and things that can be complicated in the NAFLD population more so than, say, a viral population. It also draws into question the impact of region and access to downstream therapy, which can contaminate overall survival. So I think it's not a simple binary yes-no for immune checkpoint inhibitors. According to NAFLD, we still use it predominantly in our NAFLD patients as a first line if there's no contraindications. But I think it's a really important way to think about HCC, that they're not homogenous, and viral etiology versus non-viral are different in a lot of ways, not just immune microenvironment.
So our crack RTP team saw that there was this paper that was going to be presented at ESMO that kind of addressed this, that I want to ask you about in a second. But first, just to take a look at the updated data from the EMBRAVE 150 study of atezo-bev that was published in a journal. I don't know that a lot of oncologists read the Journal of Hepatology, but the bottom line is it looks like the benefit in terms of survival and PFS is continuing to extend now with more follow-up now to 15 and a half months. You still see the benefit. But what's interesting was I haven't seen this forest plot before. So if you look at the top part, etiology, hepatitis B, hepatitis C over to the left, and they're non-viral. It's sitting right on the line. FYI, we put the PD-1 stuff in there, too, if you want to comment on this. But any thoughts about this? Does this dissuade you, to make you maybe less interested in atezo-bev in a patient with non-viral HCC?
So I'll take the bottom part of the question first because it's easier. So I think we can conclude from the PD-L1 status that while they're like a lot of other tumor types, there might be a somewhat of a trend towards better outcomes in the higher PD-L1 expressors. It, you know, the overall and the unknown are very similar to one another, and it is not a strong enough biomarker to guide our treatment. And there's a lot of heterogeneity between tumors. And so I think we can definitively say right now we should not be using PD-L1 to decide on to predict response or to choose therapy. Now, the harder one is the viral etiology. And as I mentioned in the earlier slide with the Pfister paper from Nature, the OS data is very complicated to dissect out. And it is not simply a response to immunotherapy metric. It is also wrapping up into that metric comorbidity, access to downstream therapy according to region of the world, which tracks with viral status, and potentially some component of immune microenvironment. But non-viral is not the same as NAFLD. So that non-viral also includes alcohol and other causes of liver disease besides just fatty liver. So for all those reasons, to my in my practice, and I, as I mentioned before, objective responses and PFS do not show this identical trend across studies. So it is more complicated than just response to immunotherapy. So for this reason, it doesn't change my choice of the Tezobev regimen based on viral status at this time.
And we'll get into the other immune option, or what we think hopefully will be an option, Durva tremelimumab, and what your thoughts are on that. But just to finish out on this, and this is the paper that was presented at the ESMO meeting, I guess a few days ago. This is a retrospective analysis, I think 200 some cases, trying to match up, you know, all the caveats of retrospective analyses, Atezobev versus lenvatinib. I was pretty surprised they put hazard rates and p-values and all that stuff, which I don't think you usually do in a retrospective thing. But anyhow, here it is, I guess, hypothesis generating. You know, they broke it out into, as you were just saying, NASH and other non-viral causes, and compared, you know, outcomes. And they didn't report, we didn't see response rate. But in terms of survival and PFS, it looked like the lenvatinib paper of patients did better with NASH, and the non-NASH patients also did better. Any thoughts about this, I guess, hypothesis? And, of course, they concluded this is not level one evidence. If you want to test it, you got to do a phase 3 trial. I don't know if phase 3 trials are going to look at this. I would imagine they're going to start at least including it a maybe stratification factor. But anyhow, you want to sort of sum up what this all means?
I think the key take-home message is that we need to be much more careful in our stratification and definitions of viral and non-viral. And non-viral is not good enough anymore. We need to be much more specific about clinical risk factors for NAFLD versus other etiologies in our clinical trials. As for clinical practice, you know, the data are really interesting in the context of what we already know about the meta-analysis data, but there's also, in a retrospective study, there's patient selection, and there could be a lot of differences according to stage of disease where a patient might have been selected for lenvatinib because they're earlier stage or right after a TACE procedure or something, particularly depending on region of the world. So I think it's hard to draw any conclusions, but it is an important area of us for us to be more rigorous in our definitions.
So one more thing I wanted to get your feedback on before you jump into the cases is this trial in progress. So I always love the trial in progress papers at ASCO and other meetings. I just, when I saw this one, like, whoa, that is interesting. So this is in a bunch of GI cancers. So this is, I think, pancreas, upper GI, biliary tract, colorectal, wild to start with. And then this combination, belzutifan, which, of course, we talk a lot about in our RCC programs, and then pembro and lenvatinib. Any thoughts about the thinking behind this?
Right. So the tumor types in this GI basket are tumor types that are known to be sensitive to anti-angiogenic therapies and have a role for hypoxia and tumor signaling. And the belzutifan is a hypoxia-inducible factor 2 alpha inhibitor, blocks a particular pathway for proliferation through HIF2 alpha signaling that may be complementary to the other anti-angiogenic therapy, which is lenvatinib in this combo. So we're certainly really excited about this multi-tumor basket trial that also includes HGC, I might add. So I say stay tuned in the next year or two for some early results.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting. And I guess, I mean, safety-wise, I don't think belzutifan has any major tolerability problems. I would assume that'd be fairly easy to do this. at least compared to pembrolizumab.
There's some potential for anemia and hemolysis, but I think it's the risk is low, but obviously the study will quantify it.
So, all right, well, let's get down to the nitty-gritty of where we are today and making clinical decisions today. And, you know, we saw a shift in systemic therapy a couple years ago, and it's really reflected in these cases as people really try out atezo-bev in their practice and get various responses. And a lot of our HCC cases are like that. So we're going to start out with an 84-year-old man with newly diagnosed HCC, a patient of Dr. Patel, who got atezo-bev. Here's the case, and here are his questions.
84-year-old with a history of gastric ulcers, osteoarthritis, and hypertension. He met with the interventional radiologist and discussed TACE and Y90, but with his age, he decided against anything too invasive. So he started first-line therapy with atezolizumab and bevacizumab and has tolerated it well. Restaging studies after his fourth cycle actually had showed a partial response, decrease in his primary tumor along with some suspicious lymph nodes as well too. And he's been on it for almost a year now and still maintaining a partial response from that. So has atezolizumab and bevacizumab replaced sorafenib as the standard of care? Where does lenvatinib and then also tremelimumab and darvulumab fit into treatment algorithms? Is there any preferences for the immunotherapies given a multitude of options with atezolizumab, pembrolizumab, ipilimumab, nivolumab, and darvulumab?
That's really interesting. You mentioned tremelimumab and durvalumab. Any questions that you have about that specifically?
Is there any benefit with that over ipilimumab and nivolumab? I saw a pretty fair amount of enterotoxicity from ipilimumab and nivo. And so is that something similar with the tremelimumab and darvulumab?
So a lot of questions there, and we'll take a look at the Himalaya data in a second. But any thoughts about this case and some of the questions he brings up?
Yes. So starting from the top, I think the first question is sorafenib still our standard of care? And I think that in the fit child Pugh A patient without contraindications to bevacizumab or to atezolizumab, the atezolizumab plus bevacizumab combination has now effectively replaced sorafenib or lenvatinib as our first line standard of care for patients with advanced or unresectable disease who need systemic therapy. So that's the first answer. In terms of, the comparison to durvalumab plus tremelimumab in the Himalaya trial, I think we'll look at those slides in a moment. I think back to the question about sorafenib and lenvatinib, I really reserve those as a first-line therapy for patients who aren't able to get atezo-bev for some reason, either a contraindication to immunotherapy, such as a patient with active Crohn's colitis, hypothetically, or, in the pandemic, occasionally in patients who aren't able to travel due to surges in COVID in the past, also have used lenvatinib over atezo-bev for pragmatic travel-related reasons, or in patients maybe with a really low burden of indolent metastatic disease who say, I'm not ready for infusional therapy. I don't want to go to an infusion center every 3 weeks. I want to take a pill. I've used a TKI, a lenvatinib or sorafenib in those patients. But all of those cases aside, in the average fit systemic therapy patient, right now atezo-bev is our new first-line standard of care.
So we'll look at the Himalaya data, but I'm just kind of curious broadly right now at this point, putting aside reimbursement issues, if you could access tremelimumab, you could access this combination, are there situations, of course, what you hear a lot about if there's obviously a contraindication to Bev, for example, would you use it in that situation? And what about somebody who doesn't have a contraindication to atezo-bev? Are there situations where you'd prefer to use durva-tremi?
So this actually draws upon our prior conversation about NAFLD to some degree, because I think all of us in clinical practice would agree that there are absolute contraindications to bevacizumab or where we feel very uncomfortable using Bev. And then there is a spectrum of conditions where we feel increasing degrees of discomfort. Patients who are elderly, very diabetic, brittle blood pressure control that are really low one day and really high the next day, we see them because of when they took their medications, people that we are very anxious using Bev in. And I think that that's where having another active second line survival prolonging regimen that doesn't involve bevacizumab will come into play, particularly as we've flushed out this viral etiology impact. So in non-NAFLD patients with extensive vascular disease risk factors, I'm going to be increasingly considering the Durva-Tremi regimen because of concern for Bev toxicity and potentially lower efficacy for a variety of reasons in the NAFLD setting.
So we'll explore that a little bit more in a second after we take a look at the data. But very common question that I hear from docs, they think they see anti-CTLA-4, they think Ipi or Ipi-Nivo, a lot of experiences with all kinds of stuff, hepatic, you know, colitis, et cetera. But the regimen with tremelimumab and Durva is a different regimen. You give the tremi up front one time. How would you indirectly compare some of the immune problems you see with Durva with that regimen to, say, Ipi-Nivo?
Great question. So the Durva-Tremi regimen in Himalaya is so-called STRIDE, which stands for a single priming dose of tremelimumab, where tremelimumab is given just once on day one at 300 milligrams and not repeated as a part of the standard regimen. And I think, while we can compare specific immune-related adverse events, I think one helpful metric for me is the risk of needing high-dose steroids. And so for the STRIDE regimen, it's a little less than 20 and 25% in the phase 2 and in the phase 3 both. Whereas the nivolumab 1 mg per kilogram, Ipi 3 mg per kilogram regimen in both in HCC as well as renal cell and other and lung and other tumor types that have looked at that Nivo 1 Ipi 3 combo, it's approaching 50%, or it was actually 51% in the phase 2 in HCC of patients who required high dose steroids for immune related toxicity. And so that's about a twice as high, you know, rate of needing high dose steroids. And that's sort of a barometer for me in the clinic of how likely is this person to have a serious problem.
So a couple of questions in the chat room, one from Dr. Kumar. If you think IO doesn't work as well with NASH HCC, why would you use Tremi Durva?
So I think one, back to the point, I'm not sure that it is less effective from a response rate perspective. Recalling again, the response rates aren't that different. If we look across a lot of different studies, it's the overall survival, and that includes post-treatment comorbidity, toxicity of Bev in particular, access to therapy downstream, second, third, fourth line therapy, which are more likely in a Western population than in an Eastern viral hepatitis population. So it's a much more complicated than just activity. But if one looks at the forest plots of the Durva-Tremi study, and let's just say we hypothetically that there is some immune-mediated difference in the microenvironment that's contributing to these differences, which again is not a doesn't answer all the questions and why the response rates are pretty similar. Even if there is the immune some population of T cells that's slightly different, if we look at the Durva-Tremi with a CTLA-4 inhibitor involved, we don't see that change in the waterfall plot. In fact, the viral non-viral difference is really erased in that waterfall. And secondly, there's a biologic hypothesis that the CTLA-4 may actually help recruit different T cell population and also prime the peripheral the lymph nodal stations around the tumor. So there may be a different biologic response to immune therapy when you include a CTLA-4 inhibitor. So I think that would be the rationale. But the other rationale is all tied to this question of toxicity. Is the decrement in overall survival related to comorbidity in the NAFLD population that might be exacerbated by a strong antiangiogenic? If so, that supports a different approach with immune checkpoint combo.
So I was commenting, Dr. Abu Alfa, in our first webinar that it wasn't that long ago when we did a CME programs on HCC. We were trying to think of what can we talk about other than sorafenib and, you know, different ways of using. Now it's like, whoa. And here's another one from the chat room. Where does lenvatinib pembro fit in?
Great question. So the LEAP-002 trial is a phase 3 registrational trial looking at lenvatinib-pembro compared to Lenva in the phase 3 context, building upon the phase 1b study, which showed really provocative high response rates for that combination, but also some toxicity. And you know, again, it was a phase 1b study of only about 100 patients. So that LEAP-02 trial will really determine its efficacy and its safety metrics will really determine its place in the standing of first-line HCC therapy. I think, you know, just from a pragmatic clinician perspective, there are going to be patients that are not antiangiogenic candidates or on the spectrum towards the end where we'd rather not use an antiangiogenic, like the brittle blood pressure patients, for example, where we might favor Durva-Tremi. I think that would be a hard sell to use Pembro-Lenva, because Lenva does have a lot of hypertension. But again, I think it'll depend on how the data pan out in the phase three.
So I want to get your thoughts on a second comment that Dr. Patel made to me. And I can reflect back. So many oncologists have mentioned to me, come up to me after meetings and frustrated that they don't, by the time they see the patient's already had multiple ablative procedures to the liver. They have poor liver function. They can't receive systemic therapy, and they're very frustrated. And then when Atezo-Bev came out, we really started to see some response rates. The first thing I thought about is, I wonder if that's going to change. I wonder if people are going to start thinking about systemic therapy rather than intrahepatic therapy. He brings up this question, also related another an interesting anecdote to me. So here's the comment.
A lot of times in the community, we'll oftentimes inherit patients after they've had several ablations and they're already had a cirrhotic liver and it's at the point where it's a Child Pugh B or C at that point.
The interventional radiologist that you were working with us on that case, was that person kind of tuned in to what's going on with the Atezo-Bev and that, you know, you see responses?
So one of the first patients that actually had started on him had a remarkable response. So he actually called me afterwards and asked me, what is this patient on? And I told him, and he was like, this is a remarkable, I've never seen it before. They're being more in tune with it now. So more and more part of the conversation up front rather than, you know, seeing patients on the back end.
So any thoughts about the interdisciplinary dynamic of HCC? You know, you really see the hepatologists, the surgeons, interventional radiologists very, very actively involved. Any thoughts about, are we seeing a movement maybe away from quickly going to intrahepatic therapy to systemic treatment?
I completely agree with Dr. Patel's comment there. Our tumor board, I think it's taken a year and a half or so since Atezo-Bev for the interventional radiologists to start seeing with their own two eyes these examples. And in both our institutional academic tumor board, but also a community outreach tumor board, I'm starting to hear the IR docs or the surgeons say, hey, this is probably a good Atezo-Bev patient, you know, Katie or whoever the oncologist is there, you want to see them. And it's happening a lot earlier. And instead of doing a Hail Mary where people or feel just obliged to try something and don't have a great confidence in any of the choices, people are saying, let's try this earlier, and then we can always go back to liver-directed therapy if it didn't work.
So we'll see if the interventional radiologists learn anything about durva-tremi as well. Here's the Himalaya study. We've talked about it before. Kind of looks a lot like Atezo-Bev in terms of the advantage over sorafenib, at least indirectly. They had this other arm that was durva alone that didn't seem to do as well. Any comments, any other things you want to say about this trial? There was clearly an advantage seen with the STRIDE regimen, and you were talking about tolerability. We saw this data just presented again at the ESMO GI meeting, looking at the Himalaya study based on liver function, which I think is really interesting. And the first thing, of course, is you all did use the different type of grading for cirrhosis. You have the ALBI system. But the bottom line, this is just presented. It doesn't look like there's that. I mean, it looks like they benefited regardless whether ALBI 1 or 2 or 3. Any thoughts about this? And also how you convert ALBI to Child Pugh?
Right. So the ALBI score is a calculation, purely mathematical, of the albumin and the bilirubin, which is really nice for a clinical trial purpose because it can just be extracted from a database and doesn't require the subjectivity and heterogeneity of clinicians calling, you know, mild, moderate, or severe ascites or encephalopathy, which are quite subjective. So it's a little pure of a metric, particularly in clinical trials. Roughly, ALBI grade 1 is going to be a Child Pugh A5, as good as it can be. And ALBI grade 2 is either, you know, somewhere between A5 or A6 in a Child Pugh. And grade 3 is more likely to be a B7, although, they don't convert perfectly. Otherwise, we'd just use one or the other. But in any case, I think we always know that a higher Child Pugh score, higher ALBI grade, meaning worse liver function, patients have greater toxicity, shorter time to event endpoints like PFS or OS, and usually lower response rates because they have less time to respond. They have more competing comorbidity. So it's really reassuring to see quite similar numbers for this objective response rate and median duration of response for both subgroups. And likewise, this table you're showing here. the toxicity here, it's really, I think this is highly encouraging for a CTLA-4-based combination to see if you look, say, that the treatment-related adverse events leading to discontinuation, that's sort of a metric I think is important. And we see that the discontinuations due to adverse events are quite similar for grade 1 and grade 2/3 ALBs. And conversely, if you look at sorafenib, we see more patients in the higher ALB, twice as many almost, discontinued. And that's fits with what I see in clinical practice, is that we usually tend to stop a TKI earlier for toxicity in the poorer liver function. And this
kind of
paper,
interesting too. Yeah, totally.
This is also reinforces that same principle that liver function is preserved or not harmed by the Himalaya Durva-Tremi regimen, in that the green and blue lines are nice and static, no major change in liver function, where the sorafenib, you know, probably correlating with progression more so than toxicity, I would guess in this case. But it reassures that the CTLA-4 in the Himalaya regimen is not causing undue hepatotoxicity.
So I'm just going to flip through. People can check out some of these papers we put in there if you want to learn more about Durva and Tremi and read about a lot of the basis for it. But let's get back to some cases. This is a patient of Dr. Brenner's, a patient with HCC and lung mets, who gets frontline atezo-bev and doesn't really respond. Here's his questions.
I have a patient right now that just failed atezo-bev. So, you know, we have this whole armamentarium of second-line drugs, but they were all post-sorafenib. So the question for investigators is there science or rationale behind choosing one agent over another in the second-line setting? He had significant pulmonary metastases that clearly progressed on therapy. Alpha-fetoprotein was over 30,000. So I'm going to treat him with dose-reduced cabozantinib. 40 milligrams. And then what do we do about patients who have Child's Pugh B8? I've been treating those patients. You know, you could have a 1-point difference in INR or bilirubin that makes a difference between a Child's Pugh AB. That's important for a clinical trial, but I think in real world practice, it doesn't make any sense to deny patients potentially much more effective therapy based on very small differences. The other common question I have is, in patients who have disease confined to the liver, how do we determine which patients should be considered for surgical resection versus interventional procedures such as Y90, or even when do we consider referral for potential transplantation?
You feel like you're walking down the hall and you're making rounds and they're throwing questions at you right and left. Anyhow, you want to tackle a few of those?
Yeah, I think the first one is the question on everybody's mind of what to do in the second line after atezo-bev, because we don't have prospective randomized trial data to tell us yet. I will highlight a trial that's ongoing called IMbrave 251, which looks at patients who had progressed on atezo-bev and get randomized to either lenvatinib or sorafenib according to physician's choice, or the combination of lenvatinib plus atezolizumab continuation or sorafenib plus atezolizumab continuation according to the physician's choice of TKI. But the randomization is either to continue the atezo or not, and then TKI is used second. So it doesn't really address the question of which TKI to use in the second line, but it does address the question of, is there benefit to continuing the PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor after first line? So we don't have any results from that trial yet, but that is, I think, one of the key questions on the table right now. The second question, which is what was posed, was which TKI to use. And I'm curious to hear, Neil, what Ghassan answered in his response. I think I'll put my money down first, which I think either cabozantinib or lenvatinib are both very reasonable choices. Sorafenib, if a patient has comorbidities and really compromised liver function, I might use sorafenib in a patient that I'm more worried about decompensation in, just because it has a longer track record of safety and more deteriorated liver function. But cabozantinib has the advantage of it was studied in the second or third line. And so some patients in the Celestial trial actually had received a checkpoint inhibitor prior to cabozantinib. So that in a purist clinical trial perspective, cabo has the best supporting data for using in the second line with respect to after a checkpoint inhibitor combination from a prospective data perspective. I think the rationale also works for either lenvatinib or, again, in certain patients, sorafenib.
The idea of continuing the IO is really interesting. I don't remember hearing that kind of strategy in other solid tumors at all. Maybe they're doing it, but I haven't heard, you know, like the trastuzumab kind of idea. Keep it going and switch the partner, I guess. What about ramucirumab? This patient had an AFP over 30,000.
So great question. I think, you know, the data for ramucirumab after bevacizumab in HCC has not been studied. And, you know, obviously there's some data for antiangiogenics post-progression on Bev and RAM post-progression on Bev in colorectal, for example, but we don't have such data yet in HCC. I inferred that this patient might be more decompensated in with respect to liver function as a child PUB-B. And so I would hesitate to use RAM in a child PUB-B patient because there was more toxicity with higher degree of liver function dysfunction in the REACH trial and the preceding trials.
That's really interesting. So I want you to take a look at this next case. Incidentally, this patient had a background of hepatitis C-related cirrhosis. And tell me biologically, why is this tumor different than the first case of the patient who responded for a year to atezo-bev? Here's Dr. Gupta. She was all excited that that was what was going to happen, but it didn't.
This is a 66-year-old male who, when he presented to me, he was in a fairly good condition. He was noted to have several liver lesions, which were noted on the CT scan. He had bilobar disease. He had portal vein thrombosis. I decided to give atezolizumab and bevacizumab combination. I thought he was a real good candidate for that, and I really hoped he would respond to it. He started that therapy, and his symptoms only got worse. And two cycles later, he displayed disease progression with not just increase in the size of lesions, but with new lesions. And I felt like, you know, was there something else that could have been done? Was starting with atezolizumab, bevacizumab the best choice? Should I have started with lenvatinib? The patient had a lot of faith in me, and I had a lot of faith in atezo-bev, and it didn't work out. One question that comes up, nobody wants to biopsy. They say it's a diagnosis made on imaging. So there is no biopsy, and we cannot do any further testing, genomic analysis. I mean, should that be something that should be looked at?
And what's the role of liquid biopsy? I would add to that one. Any thoughts?
Yes. So great questions. I guess quickly, I would have definitely used atezo-bev as well as a first line in a fit patient eligible for it. There is data presented in an ASCO abstract from first author Breeder, B-R-E-D-E-R et al. In 2021, looking at the main portal vein tumor thrombus subgroup of atezo-bev in BRAVE 150 trial. And while those patients still showed a benefit compared to the sorafenib arm, their outcomes are much poorer. And so it is very fair to say that patients with, I didn't catch if this patient had main portal vein tumor thrombus, but with extensive vascular invasion and main portal vein tumor thrombus or a VP4, either bilateral or main, the outcomes are just worse. And that's why those patients have been excluded from some of the other programs, including the LiPo2 and including from Himalaya too, for that matter. So this patient had some poor prognostic factors going into it. So I would have used atezo-bev, but again, looking at the disease control rate, you know, 20 to 30% of patients will have primary progression even on atezo-bev, even though it's so successful overall. So this sounds like just one of those patients, and maybe because of his extensive vascular disease, vascular invasion by tumor, he was predisposed. But I think it brings up, I didn't get a good chance to peruse the scan on this, but the question about biopsy is a really important one. And while historically, I think, you know, a decade ago, that was the party line in a hepatocellular carcinoma, particularly with an eye to the, you know, the possibility of someday maybe transplanting patients, I think our perspective in the medical oncology realm has completely changed, and that if there's ever any doubt, we strongly vote for getting a biopsy, because missing an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma can significantly change a patient's outcome with other more active therapies for cholangio, for example. There's an interesting study of the UK system that showed that there is a potentially up to about a 10% failure rate of just using a LIRADS 5 type radiographic criteria in patients with calling them HCC. They're going to be either mixed HCC cholangio or cholangio, and up to around 10% of the time. That was published as a national audit earlier this year, Childs et al., not to be confused with Child Pugh, but Childs. So I favor biopsy when anytime in doubt, and if there's any question at all, I advocate for getting a biopsy. I don't think a liquid biopsy helps most of the time, but if you catch an FGFR2 fusion or an IDH1 mutation, it can definitely, or KRAS for that matter, something that's more likely in cholangio, it can bias you to say, oh, I better really biopsy this because this doesn't fit.
Interesting, KRAS. We'll get to that in a second. One more HCC case, 82-year-old man with NASH liver cirrhosis, incidentally. This is sort of life with atezo-bev and how you deal with it. Let's hear what Dr. Schaefer has to say about this case.
82-year-old male, good performance status. He had Y90 and then subsequently progressed with retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy, gastrohepatic, periaortic, and gastrohepatic ligament. We started him on atezolizumab and bevacizumab. He has a good partial response on the first line with atezolizumab and bevacizumab per IMbrave 150. And unfortunately, he started developing proteinuria. We evaluated with nephrologist, and he did not meet quite criteria for nephrotic syndrome. Unfortunately, he developed acute small lacunar infarct. So now he's still in good performance status, good response. And my question, would faculty use in the second line, considering that this patient developed lacunar infarct as well as hypertension? Another question is challenge. This patient has high alpha-fetoprotein, and another regimen is ramucirumab. However, we don't really know what is the role of second VEGF inhibitor.
So any thoughts about the case? This patient actually is responding. So when she brings up second line, you know, it's like maybe what will happen in the future, but also whether to continue it. Now you had proteinuria, you have this lacunar infarct. Any thoughts?
So I think this harkens back to this theme we've talked about a lot already, which is what's different about NAFLD patients? Is it immune microenvironment or is it downstream issues on antiangiogenic therapy? Is it the stroke, the hypertension, the nephrotic syndrome that happens on Bev, or just independent of Bev, even in a NAFLD population? And so just to underscore that not all of it's a lack of response to immune checkpoint inhibition, but it's what happens on antiangiogenic therapy or independent of all of it. So this kind of patient, the older NASH fatty liver patient, I don't know if he has diabetes, but those patients are more likely to get proteinuria or other hypertension, other complications on Bev. It does, you know, make us quite interested in having the option of a durva-tremi that doesn't have antiangiogenic therapy. Proteinuria can be very difficult. I've had a lot of patients just like this who have any older men, diabetes, hypertensive, and it is hard to reverse. And nephrotic syndrome does it predispose to even other complications like clots. So I would say first, if the patient's still responding, I would continue as atezo monotherapy, as you alluded to, Neil, rather than necessarily stopping the regimen altogether. If he progresses on atezo monotherapy, I think, you know, all of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors do have some degree of risk for proteinuria. I think lenvatinib is higher proportionally in its clinical trials than cabo. So I'd probably favor cabo as a second line. And I'd favor it over ramucirumab given the relative contraindications from a vascular perspective for the pure VEGF R2 inhibitor.
So speaking of cabo, any comments on this recently published, you're part of this study, COSMIC 312 phase 3 study, cabo atezo? I don't know why you see TKI and IO doing so great in renal, but you kind of don't see it in HCC. I know they're different diseases of a similar concept. Anyhow, any thoughts about this study and why it was negative?
Yeah, so this is a study very, you know, obviously very involved in running the study. The survival showed really no difference between the two arms, as you've shown here. The dual primary endpoint of progression-free survival did favor the combination arm and showed a benefit. But, you know, exactly why the overall survival didn't mirror that, I think, is perhaps related to population. This occurred during COVID, and so the proportion of patients with hepatitis B were much lower, which again harkens back to how predictive of a marker is viral infection. And it may be wrapped up into the populations being studied, but it's hard to fully understand.
So here's another paper people might want to check out. I want to get to biliary tract, but I got to ask you one other question because you were at a symposium we did right after the Himalaya data was presented. And when we asked Dr. Abu Alfa what he thinks about first-line therapy in our webinar, he gave the same answer he gave then, which is he was the PI, but he's into the Himalaya strategy, the STRIDE regimen. So my question to you is, if you had a patient who was presenting for first-line therapy, no contraindications to Bev, but had seen Dr. Abu Alpha first, and he recommended, let's assume you could get Durvitremi, and that's what he recommended, would you say, I agree with that? Would you say, wouldn't do that, I'd use Atezo-Bev, but I think it's a reasonable option? Or would you say, I don't think that's a good option?
So I think first I'd couch my answer in a, we can't compare outcomes across trials because there are too many differences in eligibility criteria and timing and all the population differences. So we really can't compare apples to oranges. I think right now I'm making the decision between those two regimens based on comorbidity profile. Until we learn more about NASH and NAFLD microenvironment, I think it's really about comorbidity and risk factors for anti-angiogenic therapy and immunotherapy too, for that matter. In a vacuum, I myself have been choosing Atezo-Bev for the fit non-comorbid patient because the response rate, I think, is the absolute numbers comparing between trials, which I just said you shouldn't do, is higher. And we see, you know, an 8% rate of complete responses. That said, I think longer term follow-up will be very important as we look at, say, the Himalaya data. We see, you know, the 3-year survival rate for the STRIDE regimen is 30%. I'd like to see the long-term, you know, landmarks for Atezo-Bev as well and compare those again with the caveats of cross-trial. I think back to walk back what I said, I think right now we can't draw direct comparisons across trials. And so it's really a patient-by-patient comorbidity-driven decision.
All right, let's talk a little bit about biliary tract cancers. And of course, the TOPAZ data was presented at the same meeting, the GI ASCO meeting, had two gigantic papers this year, at least in terms of these topics. So pretty much straightforward, chemo plus or minus IO. We've seen that story before. That is standard in lung cancer. Or actually IO alone also is a possibility in lung. Any thoughts about what was seen? It looks like a modest improvement, not a huge downside. I hear a lot of people saying, you know, it wasn't maybe a home run, but I'd like to do it. Is that the way you see this?
Yep. I think, we're not seeing a huge synergy signal that we're converting a ton of patients to immunotherapy responders, but it looks like across all the endpoints, you know, from objective response to progression-free survival to OS, the addition of Durva improves all of those metrics quite symmetrically. And across subgroups on that forest plot you just showed, they're pretty similar and thankfully without a safety signal. So it's, you know, while I would caveat the data saying we're not seeing a dramatic increase of converting immune non-responders to responders, there appear to be a subset that are, because the tail of the curve actually grows with time. The proportion with ongoing response and survival is slightly greater at the, you know, with landmarks passing. So to me, those are all metrics that show it's a positive study and it helps. It doesn't help quite the percentage of patients I would have wanted to, but you know, then it's consistent and statistically significant.
Any thoughts about this data that was just again presented at the ESMO GI meeting, now looking at tumor location and type of tumor? It kind of looks like, when you look at the forest plot, it looks like everybody benefits, intrahepatic, extrahepatic, gallbladder. Any other comments about this sort of subset analysis of TOPAZ-1?
Yeah, you know, going back to our theme of, you know, viral versus non-viral disease and immunotherapy, the groups that are interesting here, I think, are Asia versus other, you know, bearing in mind that intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma also tends to be a disease with a risk factor of viral hepatitis, and Asia has a higher proportion of patients with Hep B positivity as the cause of their liver disease, whether it leads to cholangio or HCC. But it's reassuring to see a very similar trend for all the forest plot subgroups, whether Asia or Europe. There was another poster that looked at viral versus non-viral, which again showed a more prominent benefit for the viral group, but still a benefit for non-viral that mirrored it. So I think overall we are seeing more pronounced benefit in Asia and non-viral, both in the TOPAZ-1 as well as, say, the IMbrave 150 trial, but it's not zero, and there's still trend towards benefit in the other subgroups.
All right, well, let's jump into sort of the clinical day-to-day real world of biliary tract cancers. We're going to start out with a patient, a 71-year-old woman. Actually, it wasn't really clear what the primary was, as you're going to hear. There wasn't a lot of tissue. It was thought to be a pancreatic biliary tract cancer, thought to be an intrahepatic cholangio. They weren't 100% sure, and I'm not sure it matters. But in any event, here's the case from Dr. Rudolph.
the liver lesion was biopsied and was moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma with pancreatic biliary primary based upon immunostains, which was CK7 positive and negative for CK20, CDX2, TTF1, and GATA3. My questions are, her liver lesions are very small. Is blood-based NGS testing sufficient for detection of FGFR alterations or IDH1 mutation? Is there really any reason to pursue tissue biopsy, or can we work with blood? The other question that always lingers in the back of my mind is, I'm treating her as cholangiocarcinoma. How do investigators confirm that this is biliary primary when you kind of have this situation to work with? I would love to know if I could extrapolate the TOPAZ data for this patient and use chemotherapy along with immunotherapy. It's not on the NCCN guidelines and it's not FDA approved. However, I would love to know how investigators are doing it, either upfront or is that in an advanced setting after progression?
Any thoughts?
Yeah, so to the question of diagnosis, you know, cholangiocarcinoma has historically been to some degree a diagnosis of exclusion. If there's a biopsy showing adenocarcinoma occurring in the liver, how do we know if it started there or traveled there? And so there are some cases where the radiology can really answer that for people who look at a lot of liver tumors. If there's a dominant very large tumor in one lobe, for example, and satellite lesions around it, and then some scattered lesions in the contralateral lobe, that really supports, you know, the hypothesis it started in the big lesion and then traveled. If there's signs of progressive scarring and mass effect on a bile duct, for example, like biliary dilatation distal to the tumor or puckering, like the radiologist will describe an atrophic or puckered appearance of the ipsilateral lobe, that suggests that the tumor is sort of arising from the bile duct and pulling, tugging on the capsule of the liver. So it creates sort of a puckered appearance. If you have a tumor that you're describing with a lot of little small tumors scattered throughout the liver, those are ones where we really want to do a metastatic workup and make sure the patients had colonoscopy, upper endoscopy. Probably I'd get a PET in those patients in addition to regular scans. Make sure we're not missing a small bowel or other primary. But if, again, if I think to the question about next generation sequencing, it can rule in or nearly rule in a cholangio if you get lucky and get an IDH1 or an FGFR2 fusion. If you get something like KRAS or get a lot of nonspecific P53, for example, it doesn't help you. Now, the other part of the question was, does cell-free DNA, is it adequate if you have scant tissue, which is often the problem? I do get it if I'm worried that the biopsy was just an FNA or an ERCP biopsy, where it may not be enough tissue to get tumor-based next-gen sequencing. But it is important to know that most platforms are not able to detect all of the potential FGFR2 fusions. If you catch an FGFR2 fusion, it's real and it's there. If you don't catch it, it may have been missed because there are so many different potential intronic partners, and not the entire intronic spectrum of FGFR2 be covered by the cell-free assay. Cell-free assays are very good for coding regions of hotspot mutations like in BRAF or KRAS or IDH1. So you can feel very confident that you didn't miss it with a cell-free assay in those settings. But FGFR is tricky because it's intronic.
You mentioned earlier these sort of combined tumors where it's like HCC and cholangio, and kind of, it seems like it's somehow mixed or two tumors. What do you do in that situation?
We don't really know. They have a common progenitor cell, and there can be transdifferentiation or plasticity in the evolution of these therapies or of these cells. I almost always will try to get next-gen sequencing of a mixed tumor in hopes of catching a targetable mutation in the cholangio component. And if it has IDH1 or FGFR2, I treat it accordingly. Otherwise, it's really a best guess scenario. There's some data out of colleagues of mine in pathology at UCSF that Hep C related mixed HCC cholangios tend to look potentially more like HCC, I basically talk to the pathologists and use all the clues that we have and start with pick a path and go down it. If it's truly mixed where you just have some cholangio, some HCC, and they're both there, the TOPAZ-1 regimen makes a lot of sense because you got durvalumab, which showed benefit in the Himalaya trial in just HCC. And then you have the GemCis, which we know works in cholangio. So I think Topaz 1 is a nice regimen for the really true, you're convinced it's a real mixed tumor. So that's the GemCis plus durvalumab.
So somebody just in the chat room typically will read my mind. I don't know, after a while, these people know what I'm thinking, but I was just about to show this slide here. And Hassan in the chat room asked the question of, can you see patients who, receive a first line FGFR and then benefit second line? This is a slide from Dr. Valley's program that I was just mentioning earlier. And I was surprised to hear that, you know, we're talking about covalent BTK inhibitors, pirtobrutinib, so exciting in CLL. You see responses to people who don't respond to non-covalent BTK. And it kind of sounds like there's a similar story here with futibatinib, the one in the, they all have a typical mutation kind of a waterfall plot. But my understanding is that futibatinib, you can see responses to people who've had one of the other three. Have you actually seen that? Is that a case? Is that the case? And what's the reason? I guess it's covalent. Does that have something to do with it?
Well, actually, I think the reason is more that futibatinib, because of its binding location and its covalent properties, but it has activity against the common resistance mutation. So you'll see an author on a lot of our FGFR data is Lipika Goyal from Harvard, and she and colleagues at Harvard have really looked at the kinase domain resistance mutations that arise in the setting of selection pressure from an ATP competitive inhibitor like infigratinib or pemigatinib. And there are a host of different places in the coding region, not where the intronic fusion happens, but in the coding region where the tumor escapes the inhibitor, gets a new mutation in the kinase domain, and then becomes resistant to the ATP competitive inhibitor. Futibatinib, because it's not binding the ATP binding pocket, actually inhibits some of those resistance mutations, not all of them. The exciting part is that, so futibatinib is an option for some of the resistance mutations. There are new drugs that are being developed that are going to hit more of those resistance mutations. So it's going to become like an ALK or an EGFR story where we'll have serial FGFR inhibitors and be testing for resistance mutations to inform which one to use.
So really, I want you to hear, super exciting. I would call pancreatic cancer is the new non-small cell lung cancer. Just kidding, but, you know, there they got like 10 targetable lesions that they focus on. Question in the chat room, of course, TDXD is on a lot of people's mind. We were talking about the HER2-low presentation in our program next week, which is really incredible, incidentally, with following up with Dr. Modi. But there was also a paper at ASCO on TDXD and biliary tract cancer. I can't say it was totally shocking, that looks like it works, at least in some patients. It seems like it works in lung, upper GI, colon, of course, breast. Any thoughts about this? Have you seen HER2-positive biliary tract? Have you ever used TDXD in these patients?
I have just started my first patient. It was a gallbladder, as it turned out. But I think that this data plus the MyPathway cholangiocarcinoma cohort, biliary cohort, I should say, of pertuzumab, trastuzumab, which also showed us, you know, an intriguing durable response rate for that combination. Both of those really suggest that we should be looking at HER2 amplification or overexpression in our biliary tract cancer patients. The prevalence is low. For gallbladder, it's the highest. It's in the 15 to 20% range. For cholangios, it's lower, you know, depending intra versus extra, up to about, you know, 5% intra, 10, 15 in the extra. So it's not as common. And with such a small tumor type, this is not breast cancer or even not gastric cancer either. So it's going to be incredibly difficult to validate exactly what the cut points are for this location pathologically and to do randomized phase 3 trials. But I think that these results being symmetric to what we see in other bigger population tumor types really reinforces benefit. And I am using HER2 target therapy. And actually, the biggest practice change is to make sure that our next-gen sequencing panel includes HER2, or that we check HER2 IHC in addition if it doesn't.
Speaking of HER2 IHC, what about HER2 low? You want to use it in a HER2 low biliary tract cancer?
That, I you know, it's a much smaller numbers, so I don't know about that yet.
And, of course, you all have to get into you're already in that from the other tumors, the whole issue of ILD and how much of an issue that's going to be. Let's see if we can.
Well, I was going to raise that because I guess just a quick aside, Neil, is just that, you know, biliary does have a predilection in Asian and populations. And if we think there's a pharmacogenomic or other reason that it's a higher risk in Asian populations, that's particularly important for, just like in lung cancer, it's important in biliary to be aware of.
All right. Let's see if we can squeeze out one more case here. This is a 49-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Pavel Levin. Here's the case.
So according to NCCN guidelines, somebody with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma with macrometastatic disease to portal lymph nodes, the recommendation is to try to avoid surgical resection because oftentimes at that point, it's already high likelihood for recurrence. So what are their criteria that they're using to decide on who would and would not be a good candidate for surgical resection if the surgeon feels that he would be able to resect the disease completely? In this kind of situation, what would be the preferred neoadjuvant regimen in somebody without targetable mutations? What agents would they use in somebody with perfectly good renal function and in somebody with, let's say, suboptimal renal function where cisplatin would not be an option?
Any thoughts?
So to the question of surgical resection, I think there was a very interesting paper, I believe 2021, from Juan Valle was one of the authors. He's one of your speakers in a couple of weeks I saw. But the first author was Angela Lamarca, and it looked at SEER data as well as ENSCA European data on the impact of multifocality in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And what they showed is that intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas that are not a single lesion but multifocal have pretty similar prognosis to metastatic disease and node positive disease also. And so what it tells us is that we have to be very careful as a clinician to send someone to a big surgery when there are, say, a big conglomerate tumor with a lot of satellites around it. You take out half of their liver and they already have some biliary obstruction. That may really cripple the patient's options for downstream therapies, and they have a very, very high risk of behaving like a M1 metastatic disease. So that's based on, you know, 5,000+ patients from a combined SEER and European data set, Lamarca et al. 2021, I think it was Journal of Hepatology. So that's a caveat to upfront surgery in patients like this. I think they're very, it's the question of neoadjuvant therapy, it's, you know, it's small numbers of patients, very hard to do prospective randomized trials. But I think in a patient where you think they're likely to be advanced, I would definitely give them a good 6 months or at least 3 months of systemic therapy before entertaining the idea of surgery. Which regimen? You know, I think there's two front runner options. Of course, there's for unresectable disease, there's the Topaz 1 regimen, which is probably my first choice. But there's another important regimen to have on the radar, which also has a higher response rate, which is the triplet of gemcitabine, cisplatin, and nab-paclitaxel, the SWOG 1815 trial, which has not yet reported its phase 3 data, but in a phase 2 showed a much higher response rate, close to around 40% range. And so that regimen has attractive appeal as a short-term neoadjuvant strategy for cytoreduction. For renal dysfunction, I think the platinum and cisplatin, gem cisplatin, is low. The cisplatin dose is only 25 milligrams per meter squared, so we can be a little more permissive than, say, a full-dose cisplatin that we use in esophageal or other cancer types. That said, if the patient has really significant renal disease, gem nab-pac, so gem nab-paclitaxel without platinum has also shown good response and improvement over gem alone in a randomized phase 2.
Awesome. Well, Katie, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back on Monday. We'll see what Dr. Bradley and Spiegel have to say about what's new in management of locally advanced disease. So many things happening in lung cancer, neoadjuvant, IO plus chemo. We'll see what they have to say about that, as well as what's happening in terms of the use of Durva. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.